Hello, everybody. My name is John Billingsley. You are probably aware of me from Star Trek Enterprise and multiple iterations of me as a serial killer and child molester on disreputable television programs I will not name. You are here, Kneel Before Pod.
Kneel Before Blog presents Kneel Before Pod.
Welcome to Kneel Before Pod, the only podcast in range. We are here to celebrate First Contact Day, 39 years to go, and we continue our journey through the Star Trek movies. This year, we're going to be talking about the first one, Star Trek The Motion Picture. Joining me for this is a captain that I have decided to demote to satisfy my own vanity. Angus, hello.
Good evening. I'm going to mooch around in the background, just pouting and looking generally pissed off that I've been demoted.
For no reason. By someone that doesn't know what they're doing.
You said it, not me.
Well, everyone's saying that about their boss, aren't they? No Natalie this year. She is off undertaking the discipline of culinar. Or perhaps she's having a colonoscopy. I wasn't listening.
Oh, pray for her.
One is the Vulcan discipline that purges all remaining emotions, and the other one is an invasive and painful procedure. But which one is which? You decide.
I feel like they both feature a little from column A and a little from column B.
Well, and people would want a colonoscopy as well, wouldn't they?
Well, true.
Or rather, feel like they need one rather than actually want one.
Don't yuck anyone's yum. There's people out there.
That's true. People are into all sorts. Anyway, The Motion Picture. Many have affectionately titled it as either The Motionless Picture or The Slow Motion Picture. So let's kick off with some spoiler-free thoughts on this movie. What did you think of this? Had you seen it before? Were you aware of it before, other than, I guess, me talking about it?
I could not have told you that I'd seen this before, although I feel like every time we get to one of these Star Trek movies, I say exactly the same thing. I always say, I didn't think I'd seen this, and then parts of it came back to me. And there was one part in particular that I remembered being traumatized by as a child. I couldn't remember very much of the rest of it, which, again, if I'd watched it when I was quite young, I probably would have fallen asleep or got bored and run away to play with toys or something.
Just like this viewing.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for waking me up afterwards, by the way. So, yeah, I believe I have seen it before, as I say, remember part of it. I am aware of the slow motion picture subtitle or moniker that it's been dubbed with. And I'm also aware of the odd number, bad, even number, good school of thought. So, yeah, all of that going in didn't set me up for a particular success. But yeah, I almost watched this through a studious lens. I was kind of studying it like, what is this I have in front of me? Obviously, it was good to have you there by my side to kind of explain things as we went. But yeah, I just think it's a really curious thing, and I think we'll probably dig into all sorts of aspects of this film as we go. A really odd one for me. I have so many questions about the context and about the end of the TV series and moving into cinematic features. So it was a kind of oddball thing that I didn't really know what to make of it, even while it was washing over me.
It's a weird film because it stands out among the other Star Trek movies for being absolutely nothing like them. And it was after this got a bit of a critical mauling. It did really well financially, but it didn't do well critically. Someone decided that they needed to kick Gene Roddenberry upstairs because he didn't know what the best thing to do with the franchise was, according to some. So we sort of dodged a bullet for the franchise becoming this afterwards. I don't think it would have lasted more than one more movie if they'd stayed with this direction.
Do you think there was a chance that it could have continued on like this?
I think that's what Gene Roddenberry wanted, but then people stepped in and said, no, we need something that people actually want to watch. That'd be good. But yeah, there's an alternate universe where they made one more film like this and then Star Trek died for 30 years. Could have happened. I don't like this film that much. I do find it really dull. Is it the worst of the Star Trek movies? Probably. Objectively, you can't even say objectively. I don't know if it's the worst of the Star Trek movies. The thing is, I'd rather sit and watch this than Into Darkness, because Into Darkness offends me, but this doesn't. I guess I've sat with it long enough in life that I don't think of it in the way that, yeah, I'm never watching this again. Although every time I watch it, I promise myself that it's the last time. And now we're doing a podcast about it, so that should put a cap on it. It's like when the Star Wars prequels, Don't have to watch them again. I've podcasted about it. That's it. My connection is broken.
Laid down your definitive thoughts and you're never going to trouble your brain with this ever again.
Yeah. But when they remastered this and Wrath of Khan for 4K, they re-released them in cinemas. And seeing it in the cinema brought on a bit of a new lease on life for me in a way, because I got to see the beautifully rendered upgraded visuals on a big screen, which I thought was at least interesting or at least visually pleasing. But it's a film that is kneecapped by the special effects. It reminds me of the Star Wars prequels in that the original Star Wars trilogy, George Lucas and associated filmmakers used special effects to tell a story, whereas the prequels, George Lucas uses a story to tell special effects. And that's what this film is. There's a threadbare story that just gets you from the next really long visual effects sequence to the next one. It's just an onslaught of ponderous, dull stuff where you're just looking at stuff and there's nothing happening. And I don't think there's an awful lot of character work in here that's worth much. So it's interesting you say you don't really remember seeing it. And there's very little to remember coming away from it. There's nothing that sticks out as being like a classic moment or anything. Mm-hmm. In terms of character stuff, there's nothing you'll remember.
Well, yeah, that's right. And if it was at an age where I was young enough to be traumatized by the transporter scene, the rest of it must have just been very confusing, or all of the kind of slow, ponderous stuff that even the effects, it's just the equivalent of putting a kaleidoscope in front of my young eyes. Nothing about it stuck with me.
Shall we let V'ger take us into the spoilers then?
V'ger!
Let's talk about context first, because I feel it's important with this film. It went through a lot of iterations before it became what was put in front of us. At first, it was conceived as a sequel TV series to the original series. It was going to be called Star Trek Phase 2. It was going to bring back the entire cast except Leonard Nimoy, who didn't want to do it. So he was replaced by a full Vulcan called Zon, spelt with an X. And then time went on, and then Star Wars came out, and Close Encounters came out not long before it, and Paramount decided, hey, we have a sci-fi thing we could turn into a movie. So they decided to make a Star Trek movie. And then Leonard Nimoy's ears pricked up, and he said, a movie, you say? Now I'm interested. Such a glory hunter seems Leonard Nimoy.
They pricked up even more than being pointy to begin with.
Yeah. I'm not doing TV. A movie? This was in a period where he was having a difficult relationship with the character of Spock as well, the typecast issue.
Do you have any idea what sort of period of time we're talking about here?
Well, the original series went off the air in 69 and this came out in 79.
Okay.
So 10 years. Star Trek gained life on reruns, syndicated reruns in the US, certainly. Mm-hmm. It was always on and people were enjoying it and watching it. So the fan base came up. And they always say that Star Trek fandom is possibly the first fandom. Certainly the conventions as we know them now started because of Star Trek. So it built this momentum and it was, we have something here. We could do something else with it. And then the Phase 2 series could have happened.
How soon after was that supposed to have happened? Or was that kind of in talks?
I'm not 100% sure, but it was all moving across years. And they got quite far into development of Phase 2 as well. They had costumes made. They had a concept art made. I think they might even started to build sets and things. Mm. It would have been a lot of money at the time to just scrap it and then move on to something else.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's cool to hear about Nimoy as well and about the time difference and what must have changed for him. I'm sure there was all sorts of life and career things going on that meant that he decided to come back.
Yeah, and it's a movie.
And it's a movie. It's a prestigious movie.
We're making a movie, so get to be in it. And you get to have almost top billing.
Almost.
Almost. Always be behind Shatner. The Star Trek movie ideas kind of bounced around for a while. There was one that was going to be called Planet of the Titans. I'm not sure what that was going to be about, but I imagine they were going to go to a planet that had Titans on it.
Titans on it.
And there was a concept where the Enterprise breaks through the universe and meets God, stuff like that. Basically, they wanted something big. They wanted something cinematic, something that makes a massive statement for the movies. And eventually you get onto this, let's ape 2001, because Star Wars is a fast-paced, cool and sexy franchise, where Star Trek is the more deliberate one, we've decided. 2001 has long shots of things moving into place, so we can do that. As much as I don't like 2001, it at least feels propulsive, where this does not.
It's funny to hear Star Wars described as cool and sexy. I'm sure there's people who might think otherwise.
Yeah, but the pacing of Star Wars is quick and it's snappy. And
right. Yeah, I think that's interesting as well. I mean, we were discussing this a bit while watching it and setting the scene, thinking about Star Wars 2001 and how at the time that sort of trend was bleeding into lots of other properties as well, like James Bond with Moonraker, and you mentioned Close Encounters as well. So yeah, there was that bit of a sci-fi renaissance.
Yeah, sci-fi could make money now, and then basically anybody that had a hold of a property that they could realize we're doing it. It's exactly what happens now. This works. We could do this again.
Milk it for all it's worth.
Yeah, except there was a much less crowded landscape of things to milk. You know, Star Trek was only 70 episodes.
Yeah, and I'm kind of interested in the almost sort of monoculture aspect of it as well, because as you say, it's like an IP that they think, right, we've got this, space stuff is big now, let's make a movie. But presumably there would have been a lot more eyeballs on this because there just wasn't as much else going on, or there weren't thousands of streaming options and so many franchises being made into TV shows and movies and things. So when you've got a kind of monolithic property, you probably could bet on it and think, let's back this.
Yeah, and Star Trek was just the original series. It was only Kirk, Spock, McCoy and the others and the Enterprise and all that. So there was, I guess, no appetite to, let's make a new Star Trek thing. Let's focus on a different ship and crew or whatever. It was, no, we have to bring these elements back because that's what people love. And then it's not until years later that they decide to take a risk and make the Next Generation.
Yeah, and off the top of my head, I can't even really think of things being spun off all that much. There were plenty of TV spin-offs and all that kind of thing, but I just mean growing the universe in the way that we're so used to it happening now. People listening will be reciting many examples that I'm not coming up with, but as you said, they didn't think, right, well, we've already done this cast, let's do the next, until Generation.
Let's do a film that's set 100 years after the original series on a new Enterprise with a new crew. They could have done that, but I don't think it would have been accepted, really, because, like I say, it was this kind of perfect storm of Star Trek's popular enough on home media, as in TV. People can watch it on TV.
Yeah.
So it was already iconic in a way, and then the idea of bringing all that back was exciting to people. And my dad and my uncle tell me that they went to see the film in the cinema when it came out, and they were really excited by it, and they came out enjoying it. It's a bit like when we talked about seeing The Phantom Menace. Yeah. Came out of it thinking, that was great, wasn't it?
Convincing yourself that you enjoyed it.
It was great, wasn't it? We just needed another viewing or so to settle in, I think.
Yeah.
And then eventually it sort of sinks in. You're like, oh, nah, that wasn't good.
There was a lot of politics in that.
Yeah. But unlike The Phantom Menace, Star Trek comes out swinging with its second installment, which we all know so well.
Indeed, no Attack of the Clones.
Because they keep trying to make it. And this film is actually a repurposed Phase 2 script called The God Thing. It was supposed to be maybe the pilot of the series, the two-hour pilot as it used to be. It'd be an hour and a half when you chop out the adverts, but 2 hours of
airtime.
Yeah. And it really does feel like a TV episode they've stretched into 2 hours.
It really does.
And it's almost identical in plot to an original series episode called The Changeling, which I decided to rewatch before talking about this to refresh my memory. And it's the same story. The Enterprise comes across a probe that was launched by Earth centuries ago, and that probe has merged with another consciousness and has the wrong idea about the universe and becomes a threat and even assumes that Kirk is the creator. Although they do the twist way earlier in the episode, and the Nomad probe, as it's called, gets mixed up because its creator is called Jackson Roy Kirk. So gets mixed up with James Kirk. And then Kirk does what he usually does with sentient computers and points out their errors and they explode.
Do you think that they could only get away with that back then? Because even though there would have been repeats and reruns on TV of these old episodes, it's not like people had this access at their fingertips like we do now, where if you'd been binge-watching something in anticipation of the next movie coming out, and then you saw the film and you were like, wait a minute, I just watched that episode. It's exactly the same thing.
It depends on how it's presented as well, because it's not until someone points it out, if you've seen The Changeling and this, that you would see the comparison, even though it's so blatant, but you maybe wouldn't see it as naturally as you would now, or if something was done in that way now, it would probably be winking at you and referencing that old episode. In the modern version of the motion picture, you'd have them on the bridge and be like, this is a probe that was sent by Earth centuries ago. It's like that Nomad probe we encountered 10 years ago or whatever. Yes, it is. What did we do then? You told it was wrong and it blew up. Let's try that.
Yeah, you're right. I think that is how it would work now. They would definitely knowingly acknowledge the old reference.
Yeah, and this doesn't, which either suggests that who wrote this film had never seen the episode, or they just didn't want to draw people's attention to it, which either way is the right thing to do. But I don't think anybody's lambasting this film for being too similar to The Changeling as such. It's just an observation that people make. There's plenty of criticism to go around. That's the least of it.
I was hoping that your encyclopedic knowledge of cast and crew would be able to let me know if there was any crossover. Obviously, the stars who were involved, but if there was any crew involvement.
No, I don't know that. Although the director they got is a proper prestige director. They really want to take it seriously and get someone that was known for not doing stuff like this. And consequently, they didn't really know an awful lot about Star Trek, which didn't help. Although sometimes that can help. Look at Andor, for example. Tony Gilroy doesn't like Star Wars particularly.
I still haven't seen it.
But he did the work and he tried to understand how his take on the franchise would complement the rest of the franchise. Mm-hmm. You have the same idea with Nicholas Meyer in the next film. He wasn't a Star Trek guy, but he watched all the episodes and got a feel for the show and then got a feel for the tone and then thought, how do I evolve that and bring it to the big screen? And then he did, and everybody loves it, so much so that they keep making it.
Yeah, so it can work.
Though, as much as I don't like this film and I don't like the way the storytelling works or anything like that, I do actually appreciate the spirit of it. As in, the plot is about them getting to the bottom of a mystery and solving a problem rather than fighting a villain, even though V'ger is a villain, but I would say it's more of an antagonist than a villain. It's this force of nature that they have to deal with. There's no scenes where they sneer at each other on the bridge and make threats before shooting at each other. It's all about the discovery. It's all about learning what you're dealing with and then solving it that way, which I think is something you don't get an awful lot of, certainly in Star Trek movies these days. You get it in TV to some extent, and I don't think they've quite nailed it, although Strange New Worlds comes close sometimes. But certainly in films, we haven't had a proper exploration, solve a mystery, deal with a crisis film since Star Trek VI, really? Star Trek VI, the villain isn't central. There is a villain, but it's not the problem. The problem is the political situation.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's quite strange. And it's strange that I found it refreshing for a film that's the first one in a long series of films. Yeah, to find that novel. But yeah, I think that's probably just a symptom of what we've become used to, not just in Star Trek films, but in so much blockbuster cinema. As you say, it quite often comes down to a showdown between a baddie and a goodie and lots of CGI in the third act.
Yeah, it was probably reshot and completely different to what it was supposed to be. But it comes down to concept versus execution. This, on a conceptual level, is really good. The execution is not. That is the problem. That's what we have to deal with. And there isn't a lot of plot there, as in the mystery side of it doesn't really thread through the film in the way that it's supposed to. It just kind of reminds you every now and again that they don't know what they're dealing with until they give you the answers.
Yeah, and I found it kind of curiously enthralling, which is maybe not what anyone would have thought I would say about this, but you're kind of watching this slowly unfold in front of you. And because it was so unlike anything I'd seen in such a long time, I was kind of engrossed in a strange way, because what am I watching? What is going on here? And the mystery was there to be solved. I do like a mystery. I don't know if it fully follows through on it, but it was definitely mysterious for a long time.
Yeah. And the 4K remaster is stunning as well, so it is very nice to look at.
That's true.
They did a really good job on that. I would say it's one of the best 4K remasters of anything, actually.
Yeah, and for fans of the old Windows Media Player visualizer, or when computer screensavers used to have lines that would bounce around the screen, if you like that stuff, you'll love this.
Oh yeah, and if you like 8-minute scenes of looking at a ship, this is the film for you.
Model Maker's Paradise.
Well, at least the models are exceptionally well detailed.
Oh yeah, there you go. If you enjoy them, then why not? They're there and you get a good look.
Part of the problem, though, is urgency, as in it never quite communicates that this is an urgent problem. Every now and again, Kirk will say, this thing is however many hours from Earth, but then they just meander about and don't seem in a hurry to do anything. So yeah, we need to go and deal with this thing. The Enterprise is the only ship in range, which is hard to believe considering they're around Earth and there's a sense of a larger organization in existence that Starfleet is, but sure, the Enterprise is the only ship that is available. It's a common trope, the only ship in the quadrant. Maybe that's where it started, actually.
Yeah, they did a lot of tell, don't show when it came to that.
Yeah, and like I say, really need to get a move on and get there, and then it's 8 minutes of slowly panning around the ship to dock. Doesn't seem like you're in a hurry, guys. I get it's in space and it's deliberate movements and everything's supposed to take a while. It's not going to be quick, but the contrast is in 2001, because if you think of the famous similar scene, the docking in space early in the film and the famous music there, and it's meant to communicate a sense of majesty, the idea that space travel, at least within our solar system, is routine, and it does communicate that. That's a great sequence, whereas flying around the Enterprise is, I've seen it from this angle, we're still seeing it from this angle. Oh good, now we're turning around. Oh look, there, it's from the front now. Great, looks amazing. Okay.
Well, watching it this time and talking about it with you as it was going on definitely gave me that feeling of they've sold people tickets on the idea that they're going to see Star Trek on the big screen, and we're really going to show you Star Trek on the big screen. This is what you came for. Have 8 minutes of it.
No cardboard sets here, guys. It's all plywood now or something, whatever like material they were using at the time. We have some transparent plastic. Looks great. Look at our beige bridge. It's amazing. That's one thing they get wrong with the design of the Enterprise and so on, is it's lost the color from the original series. I don't know if that was a particular 70s thing, beiging everything up.
Yeah, the palette was very 70s, and in those crowd scenes at the beginning as well, the browns, the sheer number of browns.
And the guy in his impractical hover stepladder. I wouldn't stand on that.
No, that would look quite a tricky thing to pull off.
It's like a floating platform in a video game. You stand on it for too long and it will just drop. So you have to time your jump. Yeah, it's crazy. But like I say, the attention to detail is amazing. That opening sequence with the Klingon ships, where they spend a lot of time zooming in on the actual detail of the models, it's certainly a timeless film, at least visually, because those visuals will never age because everything looks real because it is.
Yeah, and that was a point in time or a point in cinema where they got a lot of that, wasn't it? And
yeah.
It's something that we miss, but it does seem to be something that people do keep trying to revive. There's always directors saying we're going back to practical because they grew up on this sort of thing.
It's interesting when you think about the homages they've done to the motion picture and subsequent Star Trek stuff. The most prominent one for you will be in Star Trek 2009, where they go to the Enterprise for the first time and they do a quick flyby. It's reminiscent of this, but it's way quicker. There's the ship, we're on board, let's go, rather than this.
Trying to do a similar sort of thing, but not maybe feeling like they had the cachet to be able to spend so much time. on it, but clearly they would want to give kind of glory shot to the ship.
Yeah, and they do a similar thing in the first episode of Strange New Worlds as well. I mean, it doesn't work because you're going to spend the rest of the film looking at the ship. So we don't need to spend 8 minutes looking at it from two different angles, because there's plenty of shots of the Enterprise throughout the rest of the film. But it does come to one good thing. They get to reuse the footage in Wrath of Khan and save money on the budget of that movie.
You mentioned earlier about the Phase 2 sets and costumes and stuff, and I was thinking, based on that, they must have tried to get something out of that as well, rather than just scrap everything.
I'm not sure. There are pictures somewhere. I'm sure I've seen pictures of what the uniforms would have looked like, and there was concept art of what the Enterprise would have looked like. They would have refitted it slightly, not to the same extent they did here, which is hilarious because the idea is this is the same Enterprise, it's just way bigger now somehow. There's one deck plating somewhere that was on the original ship. Everything else is just replaced. It's a new ship. Might be my favorite starship design is the movie era Enterprise.
From this particular era?
Yeah.
Externally, presumably, as you've already said, that the bridge just wasn't the same.
Well, every film has a different bridge anyway. They finally get it right in Star Trek VI. Where it has a clock for some reason above the view screen.
But is there any in-universe reason for that? Or is it just because they wanted to refresh it and do something visually different each time?
They never explain it. Yeah, it's just every time they use the bridge, it looks different. And the Enterprise even looks different in Wrath of Khan as well. They seem to sell it as being a kind of an old ship that's used for teaching now.
Okay.
It's cumbersome and it's not equipped with the latest tech and all that stuff. But I guess every time a new production team comes on, they want to put their own stamp on it. But there's headcanon that people have that the bridges are modular. You can remove them and then replace them.
Okay. So it's a bit like changing the seats in your car or something.
Yeah.
Keeping the shell kind of the same, maybe making it slightly bigger or even bigger. But every time you get in, it just looks different and feels different.
Yeah, but the actual design of the bridge looks very similar to the original series in terms of the way it's laid out. They take more radical departures in later films. So the next film, it looks way different. And like I say, by the time you get to Star Trek VI, that's the best bridge design in Star Trek VI, and then it's the last one. You never see it again. We nailed it, but it's over.
Yep, quit while you're ahead.
Yeah, that's it. Put all the effort into it. But obviously, it looks like money, as we've said. Everything about it, it just looks expensive. And I suppose every penny's on screen, maybe. Well, no, definitely. I mean, the visuals are stunning.
Yeah, and I would expect that once they make the leap to the big screen, that would be the point, is that presumably there's all kinds of things that you would have wanted to do and maybe couldn't do on television. And also when you know that you're going to be presenting this to people for the first time on a cinema screen, you really want to go big and have everything up there to be marveled at on such a scale.
Oh yeah. What did you think of V'ger as a threat then? We talked about how it's almost a force of nature. It's not really malevolent. It's just confused and it's following some old programming that probes have, as in gather knowledge and then return it to the creator. Something that V'ger has taken very literally. So what did you think of V'ger as a threat, as a situation, as a problem?
I thought it was quite interesting because it was, to begin with, unknowable. It was vast. It was imposing. They try and work out what's going on. When you first encounter it, you see it just obliterating some Klingon ships. So you know it's clearly pretty deadly. So you can tell there's a threat. And then the strange alienness of it as well was really interesting. So that kind of unsettling unknowable nature of it was quite cool. Makes me think of, always come back to Aliens, but the space jockey ship and that sort of thing, where you've got all these weird shapes and things that you can't even really interpret. What is that? Are there aliens flying this? What kind of crew would be on a ship like this? Is it even a ship? What am I looking at? There's clouds and electricity and all sort of stuff flying around. So it was very mysterious and very ominous and foreboding and imposing. So I thought there was lots of cool ideas in there, and I could see this working well in an updated version as well.
You can see the comparisons to things like Close Encounters and things like that, where it's, what is this thing? How do we communicate with it? What does it want with us?
Yeah, and I think that personally is probably more interesting when you've got more questions that are unanswered and you're kind of racking your brain to work out what's going on, rather than just knowing there's a baddie who's got evil intentions, because you're just like, what is this thing?
Yeah, and there's interesting ideas about what impression are we humans sending out into the galaxy as well. The idea we're sending these probes, and these probes will always have like a plaque on them, and they'll put blood samples or whatever on them. The golden record on, well, Voyager. Is it Voyager 1 or Voyager 2, or have they both got one?
I don't know.
Anyway, but the big deal about the golden record, as in, here's some music that represents our species. And if aliens find it, then they can use that to interpret that. But how would that be interpreted? And in this case, it's simple programming that gets interpreted in a certain way that even the now sentient machine can't understand. And it obviously calls up existential questions that we all have, as in, why are we here? Who's our creator? How do we meet this creator? What would we ask them if we could meet them? The end of the film says the human adventure is just beginning. And there's a bit of that in what little subtext of the film there is, the idea of looking within. And because it is a consequence of being human and trying to explore, that has this kind of unintended impact.
It's interesting as well, because I think it's a really cool concept. This is a sci-fi movie from a few decades ago, but it's set in a world where there are clearly intelligent computers and machines, maybe not quite to the extent that they're encountering here. But as you say, it sort of reflects back on the human condition. But watching it from today's context as well, where now where we are with AI and the concerns that it raises and that sort of thing as well, it's quite an interesting watch, thinking from our perspective, where are we going with all the things we're feeding into ChatGPT, and always comes back to Skynet and this sort of thing as well. So these ideas have been sort of toyed with in sci-fi for a long time, but now that we're kind of on the cusp of that in our lives, it's quite a strange and eerie place to be watching it from.
And it's prescient in a way, because you get out of it what you put in, as in, someone gave this probe rudimentary programming that was, yeah, just scan everything that you encounter, just keep scanning, and we want you to send that information back. And then when it gets its perspective warped, it sees that as a, okay, well, I know I'm from here, so I'm going to take the information back here. But then when it gets there, it's, well, what do I do with it? I don't have any instructions after that point. And then there's all the nonsense that occurs afterwards. But it's quite an interesting concept of, again, it's the humanity reflecting back on itself, the idea of, well, if you did meet God, what would you do about it? What would you say? It's not especially interesting in execution, but like you say, through a modern lens, it's quite interesting. And
yeah,
it seems like these ideas of sentient computers, artificial intelligence becoming self-aware and things like that have been bubbling around for a very long time, before it was even remotely possible.
Yeah, it's a brave new world for us.
Yeah. What were we using ChatGPT to do? Write Fraser scripts and then laughing at the output.
Oh, the damage we're wreaking upon future generations when this all comes back to bite them. We won't be around to deal with it, but we contributed to humanity's downfall. Sorry.
Wonder if anybody's asked it to write a Star Trek movie about something.
Oh, I'm sure.
Maybe we'll do that. We'll put in some parameters and see what it spits out. Well, it's just this again, except it's ChatGPT comes back to kill us.
It's got some very strange ideas about this podcast, I can tell you that.
It does. William Shatner's been on it, according to ChatGPT. News to me. I must have been off that day.
Yeah, I wasn't on that one either.
Just him on his own.
Monologuing.
Yeah. And you can see this idea of sending stuff out to the galaxy and have it come back to bite you in other things. I'm thinking of, say, Futurama, for example, where aliens are trying to watch the end of an Ally McBeal ripoff and declare war on humanity. And then in Star Trek 4, you get the probe that talks to whales, but it comes looking for the whales because they're not answering, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Star Trek seems very interested as a franchise or as a property in the idea of humanity answering for its mistakes, not just overcoming them, but having to someday answer for them. Not that deciding to explore is necessarily a mistake.
But it's risky.
Well, in this case, it was done without any consideration of what could happen, I suppose.
Yeah, sort of Pandora's box.
Yeah. Who could have predicted that the probe would fall through a black hole and be repaired by machines that didn't really know what they were doing, and then send it back as the most powerful entity we've ever encountered?
Well, yeah, I suppose in all the possibilities of places these probes could end up, and if we're sending out records and music and information about Earth, these could be ending up on planets where life is completely unable to interact or interpret any of this in any way. Or it could be ending up somewhere where it incenses them because they're like, oh, what? They're sending us this? It could be interpreted as a declaration of war, and then that's going to bring about an alien invasion on us. It'd be interesting to know if they have serious conversations about that possibility. If we send something out and we end up contacting someone we don't want to contact, that'll be on us because we'll have basically told them this is where we are, here's the coordinates, this is the galaxy, this is what we're like. That could end up pretty messy as well.
Yeah, but statistically, anything we send out is far more unlikely to encounter anything because space is really big.
But that's what I'm interested in. If someone at NASA has raised the concern of what if there is a warlike alien race out there that has just been biding its time and all it needed was contact and then information about where we are to come and plunder us.
You'd have to wonder if Starfleet's early missions, when they had warp-capable ships, is let's go find all the trash we've sent out and just retrieve it.
Clean up all the clues to our whereabouts.
There's an episode of Voyager called Friendship One. Again, it's a similar idea where a probe was sent out with knowledge how to build a warp engine and stuff so they could come find us if anybody encounters it, and it ends up on this planet in the Delta Quadrant because it's 400 years later, and the inhabitants create weapons that poison the planet's atmosphere and things like that. So again, it's the idea of we had no idea what we were doing when we sent this out or the consequences of our actions. You do see variations of this idea permeate throughout the franchise. We weren't thinking about what we're doing and this happened. The big ball of garbage in Futurama as well. This will be future us problem. The reveal, I don't know, it comes so late in the film that it's very quickly revealed, explained, and wrapped up. It all happens within the space of a couple of minutes, really, which contrasts with the hour and a half you've spent getting there, or almost 2 hours.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, it sort of culminates fairly quickly, and then before you know it, they're walking out on the ship, crossing the Marshmallow Bridge, and encountering the probe.
Yeah, this advanced machine race could find out that it was called V'ger because they read the dirty plaque. But they didn't think to clean the plaque.
No, they did not.
That muck is supposed to be there.
Some things you just don't mess with.
Clearly nobody really thought about that. They just wanted it to be that reveal, didn't they? They wanted it to be, oh, Voyager, okay. Mm. And then they're like, Voyager 6. Well, that's a probe that doesn't exist in our own real world. So we have to explain what Voyager 6 is. And then it's a simple space probe from that era. And it gathers information and sends it back.
It's quite strange to think that when this was written, all of these big questions were being considered. What happens when you meet your creator? You've been searching for this meaning for your whole life. So these are obviously big philosophical questions, and it's interesting to think about writing a screenplay around that. And then for part of it, well, not a huge amount, for it to hinge on V'ger Voyager and that not being cleaned or just the interpretation of a dirty plaque. I wonder if they were sort of patting themselves on the back like, yeah, we did it. We'll never see this one coming. It throws the rest of it, all the philosophical stuff, into question. We think, wait, were they really thinking that deeply?
Yeah. When you start tearing apart the logic of, so this machine race found this damaged probe, thought it was one of their own and rebuilt it. Or thought they were rebuilding it. And it's, what's it called? V'ger, because of this plaque, this writing that's on it that's obscured. It would make more sense if it just didn't have a name.
Yeah.
Because the machines wouldn't read, I guess, necessarily.
Yeah.
And like we discussed off mic when we were watching it, don't think these probes would have any kind of identification markers programmed into them. It'd be pretty simple, pointing a camera.
Yeah, I wondered about that and thought, surely there'd be some sort of code to identify this as Voyager. And if you were machine reading it, at what point was a machine looking at that plaque and thinking V'ger?
Yeah.
You're V'ger.
Because I don't think probes back then had an operating system.
I have no idea.
No.
Maybe this is the most anyone has ever spent talking about that.
We need to ask a NASA engineer, and we just don't have access to one.
Not right now, no.
Because they all have better things to do than appear on podcasts talking about decades old Star Trek movies. Somewhere out there, maybe a NASA engineer's listening and thinking, how dare he? I have nothing better to do. Just sitting here, listening to this podcast, waiting for the Mars rover to send information about it falling in a ditch again or something. So we talked about V'ger. Let's get on a bit about characters. And again, I said on the night when we're watching it, I don't think this film gets Star Trek. I know that's a common phrase that gets bandied around with the Kelvin timeline movies, the J.J. Abrams reboot movies, and there's three films where people don't get Star Trek. And I think there's some truth to that, although perversely, I think they get it more than this film does. As in, there's at least some recognition that your Kirk and Spock relationship, that's your core. They forget about McCoy, though, because Uhura takes that role more than not, although McCoy is very good in those films. But the idea of understanding the fundamentals of something and then adapting it, and I don't think this film gets it because you don't really have the banter. There's none of the swashbuckling. When Star Trek was conceived, it was the idea of wagon train to the stars. Mm-hmm. So effectively, it's a sci-fi western. Captain Kirk and his crew ride in on the Enterprise, solve a problem, then leave. That idea. This film is not that. And I'm not saying that franchises shouldn't change or evolve, but I don't think it captures much of the fundamentals of Star Trek as a brand, I suppose, as limited as it was back then. But I think it was pretty well defined what people certainly liked about the original series at that point. And I don't think this film has that.
But how does it fall now into the overall canon? Because obviously this is there. It sits there amongst the original series movies. Does it feel out of place in terms of the whole thing? Or is this just a kind of strange episode that doesn't really fit in amongst the other movies?
Well, it definitely doesn't fit in against the other movies because they change massively after this. Everything changes. The look, the feel, the tone, the pacing, thankfully. It all changes after this. And then before, you had the original series, obviously. There's the odd moment in this film that gets it. I think on the whole, it doesn't. Kirk isn't especially likable throughout the film, for example. Spock is very passive in a lot of ways. McCoy's fine, I suppose. They don't have the triumvirate relationship that the original series was well known for. They have that one scene in Kirk's quarters, but that's it.
So does it have to be explained away by a gas leak or something? You know, is it like one of these sorts of situations where we recognize that this is part of a series, but for this episode or for this film installment, there's a headcanon reason why everyone was different now?
I guess you could argue it'd been a few years since they'd seen each other. Kirk had been promoted and he'd lost the feel of what it was like to be captain. Spock was off trying to be more Vulcan. McCoy tried to retire. And the rest of the characters were essentially where they were before.
Because they always end up back there.
Sulu's still flying the Enterprise. Chekhov is still doing whatever he did in the original series. Scotty's still an engineer working on the Enterprise. He also doesn't know how it works, which is a bit emasculating for him. You've got Chapel, but she's a doctor now rather than a nurse. Kirk's old yeoman Rand, she has a scene. Stuff like that. So it's weird that you have the main players in the original series have moved on, but the rest of them haven't. And obviously the film, like the series in a lot of ways, isn't really interested in those other characters. They don't do much.
Mm-hmm. Kind of set dressing.
Yeah, Sulu says stuff, he reports stuff. Scotty gets the odd bit, but he always got a bit more anyway. But nobody else really gets anything to do. Uhura's still answering the phone. It's weird because you have that progression for some characters, but not for others. I guess you could write it off as Kirk and Spock haven't seen each other in years. So that explains away some of the tension a little bit because they've lost that kind of closeness. Spock is trying to deal with what he wants out of life, whether he wants to have emotions or not. But I just don't think it works. I wouldn't want to go and see a Star Trek film. It's, yeah, how about we spend most of the time where Kirk and Spock just don't say that much to each other or none of the characters really contribute anything. And also Kirk is actually not that likable. Congratulations, you did change it, but not for the better. What's your take on it? You've seen some original series, or at least be somewhat aware of the famous dynamic.
I think it's difficult for me because out of context, it does seem very strange. You ideally want them to have those relationships or relate to each other in the same old ways. But then jumping in cold and just taking it on its face value, I wasn't thinking about, I suppose you are presented with some of them, Spock being away, a bit of Kirk's most recent history, that sort of thing. But it doesn't really set you up with that. So you're kind of going in wanting one thing, getting something else, but not really having much of it explained.
Yeah. I actually think Kirk is the closest to an arc, but I don't think he really has one. It ends with him recapturing that boyish desire to be out there and getting his hands dirty again after X number of years behind a desk. Doesn't really say how long he's been an admiral for.
But was there, and forgive me for not knowing, but over the course of the original series, did they have much character arc over the course of a season? Or because it was very episodic, it's like a kind of adventure of the week. You're looking for the gang to get back together each week to take on another adventure. And maybe that's kind of what you would hope for in this, or once they get into the films, that's kind of what you're looking for, is the next adventure. I'm wondering where the character development or where the arc comes in across the lot, because obviously it spans a long time, and for Kirk to become a higher ranking officer, and you have these expectations of where they're all going to end up. They should all be getting promoted and all end up in positions of power, presumably.
In original series episodes, sometimes a character would have an arc within the episode, but usually that wouldn't carry over into subsequent episodes, because it's just how television was written at the time. It was designed so that you could just watch any episode and be able to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the joke, isn't it? The idea of at the end of the episode, everything returns exactly to normal. The Enterprise rides in, solves the problem, and rides out, and nobody's really changed along the way. Any animosity that may have existed within a given episode is wrapped up by the end, that kind of stuff. So no, there's no real character arcs there. What you're doing is you're watching a bunch of competent professionals deal with weekly problems. And some of those problems were better written than others. But broadly speaking, that's what it was. You knew that Kirk was your fearless leader, McCoy was your curmudgeonly protester, and Spock was the genius. And they would put their heads together and they'd find their way out of a given problem. Well, I'm not going to speak for the entire fandom, but you would think that's what people would want out of your film.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get it.
Yeah, but then you do introduce that problem of a series of films. You could be just doing them episodically, but because it's beginning to span this greater and greater period of time, and you do have that necessity to boldly go where they might not have in the TV show, or expand on that because we're covering a greater period of time now.
Yeah, although when I was thinking about it over the last week, if you wanted to create an arc that was around the fact that these characters have moved on and they're all in different places in their lives, you can start the film, if you want to focus on Kirk, Spock and McCoy, which you are because it's the original series again, and those were your three central characters. And this film is not interested in Uhura, Sulu, Chekhov, the others. They're just there, probably happy to get a paycheck that's movie-sized. You can start the film by them being off their game. They're not in sync the way that they used to be, and then by the end of the film they are, and that's how they come to resolve the issue, by recapturing that old school spirit that used to come so easily to them. But then I don't know what you do with Decker and so on, and in that scenario nothing apparently. But I do think that that should have really been your arc, the idea of we need to get this trifecta back together and operating in the way that they used to.
Yeah, again, I just think it comes down to it was made in a different time, and I guess at the time you wouldn't have known how many more movies were to come, so you kind of go with an idea, and in hindsight obviously now we're saying this could have been the idea and this would have been a good starting point for these returning characters. But yeah, because it's just this sort of peculiar thing that's sitting as the motion picture, one of however many more. Nobody knew where it would go from there.
Yeah, certainly when they were making the film, I don't think it was, we're going to make 10 of these in the way that they think now, as in, yeah, this could be the start of a trilogy. So maybe try and make one and see how you get on. Put effort into one film rather than just saying, yeah, we'll do that in the sequel. Well, if you say we'll do that in the sequel, you aren't getting a sequel because you're not doing it in your film.
Yeah.
Unless it's something like Star Wars where it's like, yeah, we're going to make three of these no matter how much people hate them. And, well, people like The Force Awakens, I guess. But it was after that point. It's like, yeah, we're going to do another two of these. We have no idea what we're going to do, but we're doing it. Whereas this, it was, we'll make one film and then see what happens. Turns out they get another 9 quite comfortably and then trouble production on another 3 in a new era.
There you go. This obviously launched a successful movie franchise, so they must have done something right.
Yeah, it put Star Trek back on the map, I guess. It created some appetite to keep going with it. But one of the interesting things I find about Kirk in this film is he routinely makes mistakes. So he demotes Decker, and Decker will question his authority or correct him. And whenever Kirk's corrected, he looks annoyed, but he accepts it, which I think makes him interestingly flawed. He was always like that in the original series. He's very proud, and some people would say arrogant, but he's just very confident, and he's confident in his abilities. So when he makes a mistake, it's very difficult for him to accept that he's made a mistake. But when someone corrects him on it, especially when it means saving the ship, he accepts it. He stops himself and he moves on. I find that really interesting. That happens at least twice in the film.
Yeah, and when Decker points out that it's his job as exec to point out all these options, Kirk does seem to kind of remember that and take that on board as well, and then start listening to him a bit more. So maybe that was a sort of character beat there, that to begin with, he's all kind of G'd up to be back in command of his ship. But then he kind of reels it back in when he realizes, no, I'm the spearhead of a crew of very capable people who are here to help me do my job.
Yeah, and it's when he orders the phasers and then Decker overrides his order, and he says, because phasers are tied through the main engines, so when they went into imbalance, they stopped working. And then Kirk's like, oh, well, you acted properly then. Okay, thanks for saving our lives. Then he says, stop competing with me. So he sees Decker is trying to undermine him, I guess, which I think is somewhat the case. Decker is clearly pissed off at him for coming in and just taking over his job. So it's funny that he's captain of the Enterprise where most of the crew are still the same.
Well, they've all gotten over it. You know, they're like, oh, we were passed over for promotion, but we're fine with it now.
Or they've sort of resigned themselves to, yeah, I'm never getting any further in this organization. I fly the ship. That's what I do, says Sulu, and so on. Know your place, crew of the Enterprise. I suppose Scotty's happy. He gets to tear apart engines and rebuild them and do all those kind of things. And then need Spock to help him fix the problem.
Yeah, never demoralized by that. Someone coming down from upstairs to be like, actually, this is how you do it.
5 minutes later and they're underway. It was that simple. Oops. Spock has the semblance of an arc with the connection to V'ger. V'ger reaches out to him telepathically across the stars for some reason. Out of all the telepaths in the universe, reaches out to Spock.
Because he's there.
Yeah. But they try and draw some kind of connection. The idea that V'ger is wholly logical and craves emotion, and Spock is emotional and craves pure logic. So the crossover is each of them wants what the other just has by design. They don't do anything with it, though.
Yeah, I feel like maybe it was kind of an unexplored sort of B-plot that started off as a kind of idea that maybe you could do a whole movie based around Spock's drive to discover more about this side of him. But yeah, it felt a bit kind of underbaked. Obviously, they give him that kind of origin as well, taking part in the ritual, and it's been part of his character for a long time. But it just felt kind of underdone because he's there and he kind of facilitates this communication with V'ger. He obviously has his kind of emotional points in the film, and he weeps for V'ger and that sort of thing. Maybe you feel differently, I don't know. I don't think it went far enough for me.
No, it doesn't really come to anything. There's no real actual connection point between Spock and V'ger. The fact that V'ger is purely logical and Spock isn't and wants to be is an interpretation I've made, although I think it is brought up in the film at one point, as in Spock says it's a being of pure logic and it reached out to me and I have to resolve this. I have to seek this out and deal with it or whatever. But he doesn't really. I guess the true ending of the film would be that Spock merges with V'ger because they each have a missing component that the other wants, but then you wouldn't have Spock anymore. So just, yeah, Decker will do it. He's sick of being demoted. He knows when he's not wanted.
You know what you're here for? To sacrifice yourself at the end.
You're not one of the named cast. You're a guest star. You know what we do with guest stars in this show? We get rid of them. They're never seen again. And in theory, that could have been an interesting thing, because think back to Generations, which resolved, in a way, Data's search for emotion by giving him that in the movie. So you could have Spock resolve his internal conflict that's been plaguing him throughout the original series in some way. And I guess maybe he does resolve it to a degree by recognizing that it's okay to feel things once in a while. Mm-hmm. Again, that's an interpretation, though. Don't think the film really gives you that.
Yeah, it's not there in the text.
Yeah, and it's fine to interpret stuff, but I just think they missed an opportunity to actually explore something. And then what does McCoy do? He just shows up and remarks about stuff.
Has a great beard and outfit game in this movie.
His Bee Gees look.
Yeah.
And you had Spock with his He-Man haircut as well when he was on Vulcan.
Yeah, they did have some strong looks.
And Kirk with his short sleeves and...
Oh, yeah.
And the guns.
Quite like that.
He's the captain, so he gets short sleeves.
It was very casual up on the bridge there when everyone was cutting about in their short sleeves.
Yeah.
Although quite medical looking as well.
And he gets a flattering jumpsuit as well, where no one else does. Well, more flattering than anyone else. These uniforms are horrible, but I think he pulls it off the best, maybe.
Yeah, maybe he got first refusal on everything and got to pick the one that he looked best in.
Yeah, so it's weird that you've got your three main Star Trek characters and they don't really do much with them, which is again why I feel like this film doesn't really get Star Trek, because Star Trek was about the characters. And like I said, there was a couple of beats where they sort of get it. The scene in Kirk's quarters where Spock explains why he's there, and you have that "will you please sit down" exchange, that was quite good. And McCoy makes fun of him and whatever else. And then at the end of the film, you have them wrapping up by explaining the message, really, like they would do at the end of an original series episode. It's like, well, we've just created a new life form, and isn't that great? And then end on a joke where you make fun of Spock, and then we go away. We fly off and do something else.
Roll credits.
Yeah. The final scene of the film, and it's, I know you get it. Okay. Where was this the rest of the film?
Yeah. Those moments are kind of few and far between, and that maybe is one of the failings.
Yeah. Spock does his own thing for most of it, like when he gets in a thruster suit and decides to mind meld with a strange orb.
Goes through some very sphincter-like openings.
Well, you did comment that the design of V'ger was Geiger-esque in places.
Yeah, it was. A little too kind of bodily in some ways.
Yeah, it's also, visually, it reminds me of Independence Day, or rather, Independence Day reminds me of this.
Yes, I agree there.
But if they're all pulling from the same source material, then fair enough. But design-wise, it does look truly alien, doesn't it? It doesn't look like anything you can truly comprehend.
Yes, that's right. Lovecraftian almost in a way, because those sorts of creatures and things that he would describe were unknowable. You didn't wrap your head around what it was you were looking at.
Yeah, and all the descriptions of how powerful it is are just, it's insanely powerful. How big is this? It is literally the size of the Earth's orbit around the sun. Depending what cut you watch, sometimes it's as big as the orbit of Pluto around the sun.
Oh, really? So even bigger?
Yeah, I can't remember what it is in the final cut that we watched. So many AUs in diameter. Crazy. Huge. It's a huge cloud. But you don't get a sense of, well, you do get a sense of how big the ship is compared to the Enterprise. So it's this tiny dot flying along the hull of this massive. And what's inside that ship? Just a small Earth probe. Nothing else. Other than all the replicas of the stuff that it's found, I guess.
Yes, whatever you're kind of accumulating as a machine mind.
It's a bit similar to the Superman villain Brainiac, as in flying through the universe, gathering knowledge, but also destroying the thing once you've learned everything because you don't want to miss anything.
Yeah, and it doesn't make for a good villain if you're learning all you can, but then just leaving things be. You've got to completely consume it to be able to know it.
Except from the camera that was orbiting the space station that got destroyed.
To be able to see that footage.
Or all those crazy angles they managed to get of the Klingon ships.
Yeah.
It's like in anything where they cut to like security camera footage and there's different angles.
Someone's cutting it together and editing it in a way that's good for cinematic purposes.
Well, we got robbed, but it wasn't very exciting, so I made it look a bit better for you, just on a smaller screen. I guess we talk about key sequences, because like I say, we don't think there's much to dig into here, depth-wise. There just isn't a lot of it. It's special effects to tell a story, and I think it's kneecapped by the special effects because it's just overwhelmed by them. But there's a few sequences that possibly prove that point. I do think the opening sequence is very strong with the Klingons. And if you think about it, at the time you're watching this, it's the first new Star Trek you've seen in 10 years. And you're watching this opening of these Klingon ships. You recognize they're Klingon ships because they look similar to the Klingon ships that you've already seen in the original series. Mm-hmm. Fine. But then you cut to the inside of the Klingons and what's going on? These guys don't look like Klingons. Because in the original series, they had smooth foreheads.
Yeah, so no explanation. And then from then on, I presume they did just look like that. So this was a kind of cinematic, we've got the makeup and hair budget now, we're going to put it on screen.
We always wanted them to look like this, honest. It's weird to think about it, that you've just radically changed the design of this iconic antagonist that we once had.
Yeah, and not even to feature them really that much in the film. They're there to kind of get bumped off at the beginning. Yeah, that is interesting. Could rework them just for that purpose.
But I did like that sequence, actually. It's a great showcase of how good the film looks, the detail on the models. It sets up the mystery of what is this? Why are the Klingons shooting at a big cloud? They don't name them as Klingons until a fair bit into the film, I don't think. But like I say, if you watch the original series, you'd be like, those look like Klingon ships. And then you cut inside and it's like, who are these guys?
Someone's hijacked some Klingon ships.
But they shoot at the cloud. The Klingon captain is played by Mark Leonard, who played Spock's father in one episode of the original series, and then will reprise the role in two of the upcoming films. So there's a nice little bit of trivia.
Yeah, little Easter egg.
Yeah, that's a cool sequence. If you think about it, there's nothing to it, though. It's just three Klingon ships fly up to a cloud, shoot at it, then get shot at, and then they're dead.
Don't really put up much resistance. They just get vaporized.
Yeah, or catalogued, I suppose. I wonder why it didn't stop by the Klingon homeworld on its way to Earth and catalogue that.
Yeah, I wonder how many probes they've been sending out.
Yeah, that's it. Why are none of the Klingon probes coming back to bite them in the ass? I don't know if they were scientifically exploring, really. So you've got that sequence. We've talked about the looking at the Enterprise. You also have launching the Enterprise, which takes forever.
Yeah, but we just got to slow down and appreciate everything that you're seeing on the big screen.
You have to have the scene where Kirk says to Sulu, departure angle, and then viewer ahead. You need to see Earth getting smaller as they fly away.
You got to give the fans what they want.
And then there's the wormhole sequence, which is just hilarious. The strobe effects and the slowed down dialogue and everything. Everything about that scene is perfect.
I like the stuff that was happening outside the ship. It looked like kind of video game vector graphics and stuff. But then, yeah, the inside the ship, that goes on a long time. I couldn't really tell what was happening, and the dialogue was a bit garbled as well. So, okay, I can tell they're trying to do something here to counteract what's happening, but I don't know what.
You mean you didn't get from Kirk very slowly ordering phasers and then Decker very slowly saying, belay that phaser order while he slowly runs across the bridge?
Yeah, and then having to help out with Chekhov, and you're like, oh, this is nice, he's helping him.
Chekhov, this is how you launch a torpedo.
Let me do it for you.
Yeah. So there's that one. It's hilarious. I love that sequence. It's just so nuts. It's actually the only weapon the Enterprise fires in the entire film. Is one torpedo.
There you go. This is a pacifist film.
A hunk of rock. Another sequence, such as it is the transporter sequence, which is one of the more baffling moments in the film. You talked earlier about how it traumatized you when you were younger. So talk a bit about that memory of it traumatizing you.
Yeah, it's one of the few things I can remember about this movie. Yeah, it must have really affected me as a child because it is a sort of very visceral feeling I get from seeing it again. Maybe it was watching it with my mom and seeing her reaction as well, because I have a feeling of her reacting to it and saying that would be the worst way to go or something like that. I just remember. Could be completely made up in my own mind, but it's all tied together there in my brain, is this reaction to the transporter scene. And as I say, when we watched it back, it was the main thing I could remember about having seen this film in the past.
It's such a curiosity because I just wonder why it's in the film. It doesn't really lead to anything. It's just something that happens for a couple of minutes, which is, again, quite common with this film. There's just stuff in it that seems there to pad out time, but it's unnecessarily gruesome.
Yeah.
We're just going to murder these people. We don't even know who they are.
Yeah, it's strange. And so early. And do you think it was to kind of establish some jeopardy or to kind of say the ship's still being configured? We're trying to do the last minute tweaks.
It's the scream, though. That's the thing that you would definitely remember.
Yeah, yeah.
That's some good sound design there.
Yeah, I think the whole thing was obviously very affecting. The visuals, the scream, to my young mind, it just all kind of seeped right in there and stuck with me.
But then they get it fixed off screen and then it's fine.
We don't need to worry about that anymore. Or even about those people who were supposed to be here but aren't.
What came back? It didn't live long, fortunately.
Yeah.
And then Kirk's like, just send my condolences to their families. I don't have time to deal with this.
Yeah, very jarring, very visceral.
Yeah, it's funny when the crew come aboard the Enterprise later on because they're all beamed in on the Enterprise transporter, and then McCoy is reluctant. He doesn't want to because he doesn't like having his molecule scrambled. But after what recently happened, it's a fairly valid fear.
Indeed, yeah.
I stepped in the people that last tried this on the way in.
Almost slipped.
Did they clean the pad?
Shudder.
But McCoy's entry is a funny scene anyway. It's one of the few exciting moments, really.
And that's just because of his beard.
Yeah, his beard and BG's outfit.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah. We talked about them flying through the cloud, which is just 5 minutes of lights. You get the odd reaction shot, which is people's face lit up while they look at something.
Yeah, like that cut to a different angle of somebody looking on in awe.
Yeah, you have my favourite bit, though, where you get the guy that quickly goes through a closing door.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great high-octane moment.
Slides on through. One of the moments of biggest jeopardy in the film.
And then, obviously, you have the evolution climax where Decker chooses to merge with V'ger and it explodes and disappears and leaves the Enterprise there. I suppose it's not much of a sequence.
It was something.
Yeah.
It was like he was in a wind tunnel or something. I didn't know he had that much hair, but it was standing on end the way it was blowing up. It was like one of those game shows where you have to go into like a phone booth and grab as much money as you can. That's what it kind of made me think of, because he was just standing there being wreathed in light and then just having his hair blown upwards.
What I thought was, actually, if Doctor Who had a budget in the 70s, that's what regeneration would look like.
Yes. Yeah, that would work quite well.
What did you think of the Decker-Ilea connection? We didn't talk about that when we were talking about characters, but you have this former lover's old relationship being dredged up thing. Again, with everything, they don't do very much with it. It's just mentioned, and then it means that Decker has to try and convince the robot duplicate of Ilea to reawaken her humanity.
It serves a purpose, and I suppose we've talked about this sort of episodic nature of the series and about how the mainstays are there to kind of do what they do. And I suppose this is indicative of every episode or of most episodes and many of the films as well, where you've got these supporting characters who are there to do what they need to do, sacrifice themselves at the end if they need to as well, provide a bit of romantic backstory for each other maybe, but you know that they're disposable and one of them is going to get kind of subsumed by an AI and the other one is going to have to give himself up for it. It's weird because you'd think that the emotional core of the story should revolve around them. I can see what they were trying to go for when he's trying to get to her memories that are locked away in this, what would you call it? It's a...
But they refer to her as a probe.
She's a probe, yeah. She's kind of a... not a proxy. She's something. She's a sort of vestige of the old character. Again, it's a bit like the Spock thing. There's interesting ideas there. If your consciousness was consumed by a machine, could you talk to any part of that original person? They kind of pick away at that a little bit, and they kind of toy with their relationship, their past, their memories together. Doesn't really dig deep enough for me to really properly get its teeth into that. It's a strange one because, as I say, they should be a lot of the emotional core, but because they're minor characters and because you know that they're disposable, you can't really do that much with it.
Well, you just have the one scene of them saying, we used to be in a relationship, and it ended kind of inconclusively, and then they don't do anything with that because the next time you see Ilya, she's killed, effectively.
Yeah.
Although one of her first lines where she says, my oath of celibacy is on record to Kirk, is brilliant.
That is good. She does have a couple of good parts. When she just breaks through the door of the sick bay, the noise and then the aftermath, because you don't actually see it happen, you just hear it, and then it cuts to it and it's just like bent walls.
The oath of celibacy line is great, because it's just, you're going to be under the command of Captain Kirk. Make sure he knows this. He doesn't care. But now he knows.
I feel like every female character should just have that as their first line. He's like, what is going on here? Everyone's taking oaths of celibacy.
And there's an unintentional connection to Kirk's womanizing ways as well that you could draw a joke from early on, where he says, I'm going to have a meeting with the Admiral that will last no longer than 3 minutes. That's all he needs. I don't think it was intended that way, but it can be read that way.
There's a lot of interpretation in this movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so they didn't really do much with Decker and Ilya, and it's weird because Decker decides to merge with the copy of her as well, and merge with V'ger, even though he knows very little about what's actually going on.
Yeah, it's a bit of a snap decision at the end, isn't it? Well, yeah. I suppose that's part of the storytelling and the pacing as well, is that there should be a lot more weight on this, and his sort of longing and desire to save her or be back with her, and this is a tough decision for him at the end. But instead, it seems as if they're going out, everything's quite hopeful that they're going to save the world and they're going to live on, and then they all kind of look at each other like, uh-oh, one of us is going to have to stay here. And he's like, well, I suppose it's going to have to be me.
Logically, it should be Spock, because we've already identified that Spock and V'ger both have something that the other is missing.
Yeah, but everyone just sort of turns and looks at him. He's like, all right,
I'll do it. What we do?
Steps into the wind tunnel and away he goes.
But again, there was a lot of that in the original series where guest stars would just disappear for various reasons. For example, you have a historian character in the episode where Khan is woken up spaced. She decides to go and live in exile with him because she's decided that she loves him after knowing him for half an hour or so. Which again is symptomatic of episodic TV, isn't it? You just have these massive leaps that people take, but you sort of accept it because it's the show. It's just the way it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just the format.
You can't have a 6-episode arc building to this in those days.
No, not back then.
But I do think that this film could have built to that decision. It just doesn't.
I agree.
In the same way that in later films, you can understand why characters make decisions, because they've spent the entire film explaining why they're going to make that decision.
Okay, just get to it already. And decision made.
And fortunately, the evolution of whatever V'ger becomes has never come back.
But you think that at some point there's going to be some reference.
I think at some point some writer will run out of ideas and think, let's bring back V'ger.
But do you think that that's, in the way that they've ruthlessly exploited Khan and the goodwill that everyone has towards Wrath of Khan, do you think this is going to fly under the radar very slowly and with plenty of visuals of the outside of the ship flying under the radar? Because this just isn't regarded as reverently as some of the other movies are, so the desire to exploit it in that way might not be as strong.
Yeah, although it could also be seen as, oh yeah, this is an obscure thing that we can do something with as well that it had before.
Yeah, I suppose. Show I'm a real devotee by quoting the motion picture.
Again, it's open to interpretation, but to me, V'ger, or whatever Decker becomes, it just ascends to another plane of existence entirely. So it should never be seen again. And I do like the idea that the film ends with them not really knowing what happened. Well, we solved the problem, I guess, but don't know what we've created. It's almost the same thing as sending the Voyager probe out. We've intervened with this thing and we've created something out of it.
Who knows what it's then going to seek.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of headcanon surrounding the V'ger thing, as in maybe it fell on the Borg's homeworld and the Borg upgraded it and send it back.
But you're not a fan of that?
No, but that's something that Shatner brings into his own novels.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they discuss it. It's like V'ger was a Borg thing for some reason. But yeah, that doesn't work. I don't like that idea.
I can understand the temptation to do it, but yeah.
I don't like how small it makes the universe. Why does everything have to go back to the same things? Why can't we just have something that's just unknowable?
Well, if you really wanted to ape Star Wars, then that would be the way to do it. Everything revolves around one family.
We just need Oscar Isaac to be cast in the next Star Trek movie, saying somehow V'ger returned.
Oh no, please.
Where did V'ger go? Turns out the Abrams timeline.
Oh no, I could actually kind of see it all coming together.
The Abrams universe will have a V'ger because it predates the separation of the universes.
I'd like to think that you've got a list of everything that can or can't appear in the...
Well, the whale probe, that's going to have to appear at some point as well. I don't know if you've seen the honest trailers for Star Trek Into Darkness.
Don't think I've seen that one.
Basically, the parody of the bit that Spock calls his future self for advice on what to do about Khan. And it's just, you have in the honest trailer, not honest trailer, how it should have ended. It has Spock just listing all the stuff they'll need to do to speed things up. And when you're back in time doing this, pick up a couple of whales, because that's going to save you a lot of time later on. So there's a lot of malevolent stuff or a lot of cosmic stuff that they encounter during the original series period that will still be out there because the existence of them will predate the divergence point. There's a giant amoeba that they need to destroy at some point. That'll be out there growing rapidly. Stuff like that. So they could do V'ger again, I guess, in the Kelvin timeline. Because it'll be on its way.
It's out there.
Yeah. They did a Nero comic that was detailing what he did in the intervening time, the 20 years or whatever it was, where he was incarcerated by Klingons and stuff. And one of the things he does is he flies out to talk to V'ger.
Oh, really?
Which tells you everything about the people that were writing it at that point in time, I think.
Yeah, some V'ger has featured.
Yeah, but never canonically, never been featured again. And not in its evolved form, whatever that may be.
Right, yeah.
That's good. And headcanon has it that this film ends with the start of another 5-year mission. And there's a bunch of comics and stuff that detail it. That's the whole idea of Kirk saying whatever it is, his last line is, just says, let's go or whatever. So don't know what happens here, because it's weird, because like I say, in Wrath of Khan, everything changes. Wrath of Khan almost brings Kirk back as the admiral that shouldn't be doing that job. It pretty much ignores this. In fact, it does ignore this. There's no reference to it whatsoever.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. So it's this weird anomalous event that could almost take place in its own universe for all the impact it's actually made on the franchise.
But it must have launched the rest of the series.
Yeah, I think it did well enough financially for them to take another look at it. Mm-hmm. But like I said earlier, it was identified that this was the wrong approach. We need to fix this in some way. We need to do something different. And
right.
Turns out the good decision was to kick Gene Roddenberry upstairs because he didn't really have a grasp of what would work at this time. You see that in Next Generation as well. He's very hands-on in the first season and it's crap. And then they kick him upstairs during season 2 when his health was failing as well, and it gets better.
A shame for him, but then I suppose for the quality of the work, then it's...
He had some weird ideas, like characters shouldn't be in conflict because it's the future and we've solved all these problems. And you tell a bunch of TV or film writers, I can't have character conflict. What am I going to do? So do you have any other thoughts on the slow motion picture? I think we've covered almost everything. Comparisons to 2001 A Space Odyssey, we touched on that. It's trying to be 2001, but it's not. Anywhere near it. It doesn't understand why 2001 is considered a masterpiece.
I think it's flawed, but I do think that as a big budget sci-fi film, it's just not the sort of thing you see anymore, really. Definitely not franchise flagship type stuff. You probably only see this kind of thing in more indie or smaller, lower end type productions now.
Yeah.
And it's a shame.
I remember when Arrival came out and I was thinking, why don't they make Star Trek along these lines? Instead of what we've been getting. I did enjoy the 2009 movie, and I think Beyond's very good as well, but also it's not really what I want, at least not consistently. You can have like one action piece, I think. You know, I don't think that Star Trek should never be an action thing, but being only an action thing, I think, is limiting. And Arrival proved that we can make something interesting. Why not just put a Star Trek skin on it and do that? And they keep talking about trying to make another Kelvin timeline movie with Chris Pine and all them, and they just can't make the money work because all three of them, they spent too much money on them. Star Trek thrives under lower budgets. It inspires creativity. It allows them to figure out how to get around those limitations. Wrath of Khan, for example, let's use the footage from the motion picture because we have it and we need to show the Enterprise launching. It just looks the same as it did the last time. That kind of stuff. Or the Bird of Prey explosion that's used in Generations, recycled from Star Trek VI. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah, that's a resource you have. Just use it. You need that shot and you already have it. And if the story is good, which in Generations it kind of isn't, but if the story is good, no one will care. And it's how you get around these limitations. So for me, with Star Trek, why not spend like $80 million on it? And focus on making a sci-fi movie.
I agree with your point about Arrival. I think that is the kind of story I would like to see in this franchise. I feel like we're never going to see anything like that. Not anytime soon anyway, because of the more recent films, because they're kind of aping a more recent Star Wars, Marvel kind of franchise model.
Yeah.
I'm just very cynical about where studios are going to spend their money and the types of things that they'll be willing to slap this name on.
Yeah, they're just missing the point because they could make a Star Trek movie on, say, $80 million, and you can triple that in return quite easily, I think.
Yeah, and I think if someone took that chance and proved that point financially, then that's where you'd see more and more people willing to take that chance, because it's less of a chance then, it's more of a proven, and that's what they're always after, is proven returns.
Yeah, and when you look at the Kelvin timeline reboot as well, Chris Pine and the other actors, they're supposed to be the original series crew in their prime, having adventures in the prime of life, so to speak. But now Chris Pine's as old as Shatner is in this. And I know that being in your 40s is different to being in your 40s back then, but...
Yeah, they've kind of missed that young, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed stage of these characters' careers.
Yeah, you've missed that window. And they even touched on that in Beyond, where Kirk was thinking about moving on. He was thinking about replying to be an admiral and things like that, because I guess he was feeling wearied by the job and things like that. But yeah, you've missed that window, because Chris Pine looks his age, doesn't he? Not in an awful way, but he does look like he's 40.
Yeah, he's not convincing anyone that he's playing much younger than that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would work with moving them on into a later stage of their career. I mean, it's probably where it's going to have to go. But I think what works about that with the original cast is that they've got this weight of everything behind them. You've seen so much of what they've done, and it's rewarding to see them move into a different stage of their careers. And with this cast, you just don't have that. I don't think it would feel the same to see them move on, but I do think that's probably where they'll end up if they keep going with this timeline.
Yeah, then they play with that in subsequent films like Wrath of Khan. It's Kirk turns 50 and he's questioning his life choices, the idea of, I should never have allowed myself to be promoted. And then that's sort of wrapped up when he gives that advice to Picard later on. He tells him, don't let them take you away from the bridge of the Enterprise, because I did and I hated it. You can do different things with that. You can still have them remixed back in the old positions they were, but in different ways.
Yeah, but we already now have a modern example of someone who wouldn't allow himself to be promoted out of a position he loved in Pete Mitchell, Maverick.
Yeah, that's true. They'll be doing another one of those.
Oh, yeah. I've got concerns about that.
Yeah, so... I think it's going to be a while before, if ever, we see another Chris Pine-led Star Trek movie. But there's potential for things to progress on TV, because you have another version of Kirk on TV at the moment in Strange New Worlds. Mm. And my theory is that Strange New Worlds is eventually going to evolve into a pseudo-remake of the original series.
Okay.
Although Paul Wesley, who plays Kirk, is in his 40s and he's playing 20s, which is a bit strange. So he's going to be like 50 playing 30s by the time we get to this potential thing.
Yeah, if you can pull it off, good luck to you.
I guess so. It's just weird, and I guess it's not to think about. But in terms of Star Trek storytelling, I'd like to see things more in the spirit of this. Films like Arrival proved that it can be done, and I don't know if you've seen it, but there was The Creator, that film. That was made on a modest budget, and it looks great.
Nope, haven't seen it.
So you don't need to spend all the money on these things, even though for this film they did.
Yeah, but not on sets. Not physical sets, because... they spend all their time just on the bridge talking.
Engineering's quite elaborate.
That's true. You do see a bit of engineering. I apologise. Take it back.
And Kirk's quarters is quite elaborate as well.
Yes, yes.
But most of the film is on the Enterprise. It's a bottle episode, a very expensive bottle episode.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I think that's us, isn't it? I don't have anything else on this film.
That's it. We did it. Happy First Contact Day.
Happy First Contact Day. 39 years to go. I was thinking about... next year, technically the films we haven't covered are 3 and 5, but you and or Natalie weren't on for Wrath of Khan, Star Trek 4, the one with the whales, or First Contact, funnily enough, the reason we're here. So I was thinking for the journey that I'm taking you and or Natalie on, Natalie's not always here, but we could revisit Wrath of Khan and talk about that next year.
Yeah, always happy to watch that. It's probably been a long time since we'll have covered anything sequentially, apart from, of course, Alien Day.
I thought you were going to say, I thought that was a long time since we saw it, but we went to the cinema, it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we saw it fairly recently. No, I was just thinking, we jump about on the First Contact Day specials, so yeah, quite interesting to go from 1 to 2.
Over the next few years, we'll be doing 2, 3, 4, because we should revisit 4 as well, because, again, you weren't on that one. And 5, which we haven't done at all.
Okay, so you're doing a kind of soft reboot here.
Kind of. The First Contact Day specials started off as, let's just talk about Star Trek, and then it became taking you guys on this journey through the movies, through my eyes. So I think it makes sense to continue that.
Yeah, let's do it.
Slightly out of sequence. Well, the next 4 years will be 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then we do First Contact again, and then, I don't know, it's several years away. I don't need to answer that question right now.
Then we'll have forgotten everything we said about every one of them, and we can just go back and do it over again.
That's it. We just keep looping through the movies.
Yeah.
We'll be back in 10 years where I'll be saying, this is the last time I'm watching the motion picture.
Yeah, we could just play the clip of you saying it every time.
Got a clip loop. I'm stuck in a time loop.
Supercut of all the times you claim you're never going to watch this again.
So yeah, I reckon we should do that and have you and or Natalie experience the entire film canon.
Cool.
And then after that, it'll be talking about episodes, I guess.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty. There's so much out there.
900 episodes of Star Trek or something like that we can talk about. We should be good for a few years.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining for the beginning of the human adventure.
I'm very pleased to have been here on the first step of the journey.
I'd like to thank Captain Meat Shield for the supplied music. And if you like what you heard, please do hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcasts, really. You can subscribe anywhere. And most of these places have a rating and review system built in, and they normally follow stars as a rating convention. So Angus, how many stars should these guys give us?
That would be 5. We would love 5 stars.
Or point and say V'ger.
V'ger.
V'ger. If you want to talk to us about the motion picture or Star Trek in general or anything else really, you can hit us up on Facebook or Twitter under Neil Before Blog, or you can leave us a comment under neilbeforeblog.co.uk. We're also on Blue Sky, which is now apparently open to everyone. You don't need to be invited anymore, which is good because I didn't have anyone else left to invite. So if you want to join Blue Sky and find us there, then please do. It's less of a cesspit than Twitter currently, although now everybody's allowed in, so it'll become the exact same kind of cesspit probably. You can also join us on Discord. We have a small yet engaged community of a listener that comments on our stuff, so you can join us there. And as always, we hope you'll join us next time on Neil Before Pod. Engage.
Peter.